Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack, to some welcome you to the 272nd episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 271 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at the web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 in the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. April is National Poetry Month, and there will be poetry readings sponsored by both the Mahopac Poetry Workshop and the Yorktown Poetry Workshop this week. The one in the Mahopac Library is on Monday, April 8th, at 6:30 p.m. The readings by members of the Mahopac Poetry Workshop will be followed by an open mic session. Sign-ups for the open mic begin at 6 p.m. The Yorktown event will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday, April 13th, at the John C. Hart Library on East Main Street in Shrub Oak, New York. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. I hope you'll be right back here at the same 7 p.m. the next Sunday night, when we continue National Poetry Month with the discussion with poet, author, and co-founder and co-editor of SWIM, that's S-W-W-I-M, Jen Karatnik. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 272nd in the series, as we begin National Poetry Month, it's poet and translator Aaron Cifolo, who also produces the monthly online newsletter and mailing, The Anagram, dealing with writing news and recipes. I first met Aaron a few years ago when we both read our poetry at the Stanford Arts Festival. And I was most recently with her this past Monday when she appeared on one with Vin DiQuino, the television show. She was on this show almost 2 years ago, and whenever I speak to Anne, I find it a real delight. The listeners wishing to join Anne and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call of participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. But let's get started. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Oh, thanks, John. I'm glad to be a repeater.
So would you start us off with the poem?
Oh, sure. I'm going to read a poem from my first book, which is called Face Painting in the Dark. And it's called Wildlife. This morning, wild turkeys, like a string of black pearls, break across my ochre lawn. A dozen, little, wise enough to lift in gobbles to low poplars, as a coyote pup, all inked face and tail, emerges from a mulberry bush, stunned by the sight of the brown-orange tribe, but spurred by easier rodent scents to sun-shadowed pine depths. Returning elders to peck, serenely gather their young, whom I'd love to follow single file up the empty stream, a last poult, belly full, eager to one day spread my autumnal fan. But I am already with the awed coyote, racing the woods' hungry heart.
I haven't seen any coyotes in the area, you know, recently. There's a concern with all the small animals here, obviously, and everyone warns people with small dogs, don't let them off the leash. But I haven't seen many in the area. I also haven't seen a rabbit in about 3 years, so I don't know what's going on.
Well, about 2 years ago, I saw two coyotes ran in front of my car on a back street near my house, and I thought they were German shepherds, just loose. And they were running together, and when I realized they were coyotes, I was so flipped. I pulled my car over, and I called the police, and they said, "Yeah, they're around." And they said that they travel down the train tracks, Metro North, and there are a lot of golf courses, and they feast on the Canadian geese. And they make their way south, so that's why they're around here.
Oh, wow. Thank you for the poem. I liked it. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Scarsdale, where I live now, and I went to school at a lovely school called Edgewood, which just this weekend is celebrating its centennial. And I just, on Friday, I was there for their career day talking to kindergartners and also fifth graders about being a poet. And it was enormously rewarding, and it's still a very special school, a nice community feeling. And the teachers there really make every student feel very special and talented, and there's no sense of competition. And it's just a great school, so I was really happy to go back and see it's continuing its fine tradition of education.
Did you capture any young poets?
You know, I don't think, kindergartners, I don't think they even know what they are yet, or just the fact that they're in school. They were pretty classic little kids. But I have to thank my friend, the poet Linda Simone, because she suggested I hand out a haiku to each of them which I did. I had a haiku. I printed about 10 haiku on colored paper, and then I cut them in strips and, you know, reproduced them. And I told them that it was National Poetry Month, and they had to put these in their pockets. And it was all different haiku, so when I handed them out, they went nuts. They were like, oh, yours is different from mine. And we were carefully folding them and putting them in their pockets as told. And that was enormously rewarding.
Great.
Yeah, I was very happy to see that.
Do you remember what your own earliest aspirations were?
You know, back there in Edgewood, you know, all my teachers would told me I was going to be a children's book writer and illustrator because I loved doing, you know, drawing and painting, and I loved writing. So it sounded good to me. I certainly, you know, wanted to do something involving writing and art. And it just made sense. I didn't agonize over it.
Were you an early reader?
No, I think I was, you know, pretty normal. I didn't really read until school, and then, you know, my mother got us library cards and, you know, went and got lots of Dr. Seuss out, and you know, I was a pretty average young reader, but I loved it. And my mother really encouraged us to read. She got us little nightlights that we attached to our bed frames, my brother and I, because she wanted us to, you know, read in bed and read before sleep. And, you know, little subtle things like that really instilled in me a love of reading.
That's great. Most people that I know, myself included, had our own flashlights to read under the covers when we were sent into bed. So you were just the opposite. You were given courage to.
Yeah, exactly.
What about your high school years? Where'd you go then?
High school was Scarsdale High, and that's when I started, you know, writing sort of like the teenage angst poetry, but it felt a little more crafted, so I submitted it to the literary journal that a friend of mine had started, and then I got involved with that literary journal, and then I became the editor in my senior year of the official literary journal at the high school, and that was rewarding too. So, yeah, it was more poetry that I was writing in high school than anything else.
Did your friends, the literary journal, continue after you?
Yes, because it was during my term. I renamed it, and I had it come out more often, and it was it's not as expensive to produce. I mean, I really kind of redid it, but I know it continued. You know, there's always been the literary journal at the high school.
How about another poem, as long as we're talking about your early poems?
Sure. I guess what I'd like to read is, this is the poem I read to the kindergartners. It's from my book Free Fairy, which is a dual narrative book-length poem. The top covers 1960s suburbia, and it's really based on my growing up and going to Edgewood School. It plays a big part. So this poem is called School. Red brick sits on square suburban block, overseeing playground, arbor, its cream cupola. One corner, kindergarten is, pines drop sepia needles, fir scent September air, shelter youngest who tentatively enter there. Northwest, backyards edge woods that welcome explorers to rock ledge, sun-dappled trees. Sense of those before. Listen, Orpheus whistling in the leaves.
Did they ask you who Orpheus was?
Well, I told them beforehand. That was a name I gave for my parents in this book is Orpheus and Eurydice. So, yes, and my father had gone to the school before me. So,
wow, that's terrific. And what happened after high school?
After high school, I spent 1 year at Connecticut College in New London, and that's a great school. It's just terrific. I was sort of doing more exactly of what I had done all through, you know, the Scarsdale education system, which was, you know, writing and art, writing and art, writing and art. And all of a sudden I got really sick of it. So I came home and I transferred to Sarah Lawrence and I just dove into liberal arts and made myself take things I would never take, which, you know, economics, theater, you know, sociology, psychology. I just wanted a full liberal arts experience. And at the same time, really the only literature I did at that time was French literature. So.
Oh, were you still writing, though? Sarah Lawrence?
No, you know, John, I just didn't. I felt like I was on this premature trajectory, you know, from kindergarten all the way to my freshman year, you know, up in New London. It was just all writing, art, and I just rebelled. And so I stopped writing until I picked it up again. Wow, when did I pick it up again? I think probably like my early 30s. Yeah.
In addition to your writing and translation work, you have a business career as a creative strategist. So would you explain what that is and take a brief history there?
Yeah, I have a company called Jumpstart, and really for the past 20 years I've helped pretty big corporations like Verizon and IBM figure out, you know, projects that they wanted to do involving writing, either in-house projects, internal communications, or external communications. So to give you an example, IBM hired me to help them with a booklet that covered the history of diversity at IBM, and I got to go up to, you know, Somers and dig around the archives and discover pictures of Thomas Watson, you know, shaking Helen Keller's hand. And then, you know, for, say, a bank like HSBC, I did a timeline of the start of banking in the United States. And what was really nice about that project was I won an award for it. And then the Smithsonian got a copy of it, and they were so inspired by it that they came out with a book like 2 years later on the same topic.
That's great. Now, you do have an incredible number of poetry publications in various reviews and journals that we'll get into shortly. Were you writing and submitting all the while you were engaged in these other business activities?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I decided I wanted an MFA, so I went back to my alma mater, Sarah Lawrence, and while I was working, I got my graduate degree, and started submitting and, you know, really trying to get my work out there and trying to improve my work. And it was really rewarding because having my own business, I could schedule my time so that, you know, I could meet the demands of my clients and then use the extra time for my own work.
You've also won a number of awards over the years, including the prestigious Robert Penn Warren Award in 2001. But your first three awards had to do with newsletter writing and business communications rather than poetry. Would you take us through the awards?
Well, the first one, you know, and I have to thank the people I'm still friends with from the National Writers Union, Sarah Bracey White and Linda Simone and Terry Dugan. They were all officers at the National Writers Union, and they encouraged me to become editor of the newsletter for the Westchester Fairfield chapter of it. And I agreed, and I used the newsletter really for my own portfolio, but I also encouraged other people to have columns and write frequently and have bylines so they could use it as for their portfolio too. So it became a really great vehicle for our chapter, and our chapter was one of the most vibrant NWU chapters in the country, and we were doing really well. And the newsletter was part of that, so I sent it out, and I think I got it's something called an Apex Award for that newsletter. And then the I mentioned the HSBC booklet on the history of banking, and that was an the International Association of Business Communicators. And if you're in the business of writing, that's a very familiar group in New York City, and they gave us an award recognizing that booklet, which was chock full of photos and beautifully designed by a graphic designer named Lorraine Pirro. And I think that's it, John.
Speaking of writing, how about one more poem?
Okay, sure. Let me poke around. Free Fairy, the bottom narrative is about the development of plutonium. So it's really a story of the Manhattan Project and its impact on 1960s America. So there's a little bit of a tension. I'm not going to read any of the parts of the poems on the bottom narrative, but I'll read the top, and you can hear the tension of that era, which was so, you know, idyllic, and yet at the same time we had this sense that anything could happen worldwide. So, cartography. Our road is a river filled in, once meandering stream, its curve a waterfall, each parallel blank, rock wall, subterranean reservoir making houses, Tudor, prairie, colonial, tilt, while star-spiked ornamental maples, tulip trees, drink, mineral silt, valley between estates to east, two white mansions, one Victorian, and lost dirt drives to west, isolated homes, sunset turns an orange glow, almost forgotten in north-south grid, every yard held like a levee by an upper ledge, suburbia, but on its edge.
Yeah, you're obviously right about the tension, but the tension was really only between the people who knew enough about it, like the scientists versus the military. I heard this terrible story on NPR yesterday about Anna Wetok. Before they were doing the bomb testing, they had soldiers on the island who, without their knowledge, they were subjecting them to gas to see how it affected them, were they able to carry on. And most of the soldiers were Puerto Ricans who didn't speak English.
They did terrible things. I mean, they, they put animals on boats out in the Pacific to see how, when they tested, the bombs, what would happen. And of course they were evaporated, and it's just, it's not a happy time, that's for sure.
Before returning to a chronological career, I noticed that the translation of the French work is not only your most recent book and second a translation from the same author, but it's the subject of your most recent award. What languages are you fluent in, and how did you get into translation?
Well, I mean, I can say I'm fluent in French. I probably couldn't rip into a conversation with a native French speaker, but I could certainly read some French and understand what it says. I have a decent understanding of Spanish, and really that's about it. I just kept up with French all through school. My father's ancestors were French, so I felt like it was a duty. I had to learn French when given the choice in sixth grade between French or Spanish. So, and it wasn't fun learning it, I have to say. Not until I got to college and I could relax. All those conjugations, it was a little painful. But I stayed with it, and I stayed with it because I had a college advisor who said to me, listen, keep it up because maybe it'll help you get a job. And it did. For the first 10 years before I went out on my own with my own company, I worked for two French companies. And I did get a higher salary than most because I was bilingual, and that was a very interesting experience working for a French company in the United States, just the cultural dynamics there and really learning another culture and respecting it. And so when I finished my degree, my MFA, I said to myself, you know, I know French. I'd love to try my hand at translating. So I queried all these places in France, the Sorbonne. You know, we had email then, so I emailed as many people as I could. You know, and all the famous people were taken. And so somebody recommended Hélène Sanguinetti, and just because she was free, I said, great. And I ordered her book, and I dove right in, and I couldn't believe when I sent out just, you know, morsels of her work translated that these very fine literary journals in the United States really snapped it up. They just, it sort of opened a whole doorway for me, and I walked through it.
I was going to mention that you've translated many individual poems by the same author and published her work in a number of American journals. How did you build up such a working relationship, and have you ever met her in person?
You know what? I didn't want her to know that I was translating her work because in my mind I thought, you know, a poet would be very domineering and want to get involved with the translation. So she actually reached out to me because the publisher tipped her off that I was translating. So she was incredibly gracious and really took a hands-off approach and just offered herself to explain anything that was naughty or difficult. And then the first book that was published by Seismicity Editions out in Los Angeles, we were both flown into L.A., so that, you know, that was the first time I met Hélène. No, I'm sorry. I met her in New York. First she came to New York, and that's when I first met her. It was in New York City. And then when our book came out, the publishers flew her, both of us, to L.A., and we had time to, you know, read together. We read at USC, we read at Otis Institute of the Arts. It was just great. And she's incredibly gracious, a gracious,
lovely person. Now, explain that. You said that you didn't want her to know. Don't you need permission if you take someone's work and if you translate it, or do you not because you're putting it into a different language?
No, you know, you need permission, but I'm telling you who you need the permission from is the publisher.
Oh, okay.
So I had written the publisher and asked for permission, and he said, fine. But I didn't write her. So
Okay. That's
when he tipped her off, and she got in touch with me.
Now, what originally led you to her work, other than she was available? Was there anything specific about her work that you liked or you thought it was very important?
No, I'm telling you, it was available. I mean,
okay.
I spoke to... I hesitated because I read one little poem she had written, and I there were no thunderbolts, or, you know, I didn't hear the Hallelujah Choir, and I didn't know whether I should go with it. But then I had called like a very famous translator and French literary person at NYU, and I had left a message, and she called me back, and I said, I'm looking for someone to translate. And she said to me, good luck. If you find someone, let me know. And she hung up on me. And
as I'm
listening to the dial tone, I'm saying, you know what? I think I'm going to go with Hélène. I said, let me order her book. And it turned out her work is so different from what I learned about poetry, which is narrative lyric, that it's been very good for me because it's really stretched me as a person and as a poet.
Please tell us about these books, including the current one, and then also about some of the poems that you translated for journals.
Well, Hélène writes books that are book-length poems, and they have a narrative to them, and they also have multiple voices. And I think that's why working with her really influenced my writing Free Fairy, which has a dual narrative. Elaine has a background in theater, so she's really big on voice, and it's just astonishing, her work. It's not linear. She calls her language scraped. It's difficult. It's almost like she considers the space on each page part of the poem. So it's visual, it's difficult, it's multiple voices, and yet there's always a narrative thread through it that is extremely compelling. And then in the middle of these works, she usually plops a fable, which is quite charming and meaningful, and that's really wonderful too. So, my husband, who is not a poet, says of her work that it gets under your skin, and I think that's really true. It's so difficult at first, but if you stay with it, it's really something different, and it does get under your skin.
Now, in the current book, not only are some of the voices are real people, you have the voice here, the houses. How is she able to move between characters and between a location so well, do you think?
I asked the publisher, Charles Alexander, who published this book, I said, what attracted you to it? And he said, I think it's the leaps that she makes. So she makes these outrageous leaps where you'll be on one page and there'll be almost kind of a normal dialogue, and you'll say, oh, I know where I am, and then it will, jump to a page where the words are spread out kind of like a polonaire, in the shape of like butterfly wings, and she'll make up words, and it's just, it's so creative and outrageous. I think she gets away with it for that reason, and yet there's integrity to it so that it doesn't feel flippant.
Some of it is from, well, much of it is easy to say there are different verses, but some of them, they're like their own prose poems, and others they're single lines. So it's she mixes everything in this book. Some poetry translations, the Naruto things, for instance, give both the original poem in the native language and the translation. You do not. What are the reasons for each approach?
Well, the first book, Hence This Cradle, which was put out by Seismicity Editions, that has the French.
I did not see. I've only
seen. Yes, you don't have a copy of that, John. But that has the French, and really, it comes down to the publisher deciding what is feasible in terms of page length. So, or sometimes it's a business proposition because the publisher, the French publisher of the original work, might be asking too much for to have both, the translation and the original text. I honestly don't know. I'm going to take a guess. Charles Alexander is a book designer, and I'm assuming that he sort of visualized this book as having its own space and being this very nice square size that it is. So I imagine that's why he did not include the French. It might have been just too long or too thick of a book.
Now, one more business question. Obviously, you get royalties from the book. Does she also get royalties from the English translation?
We get nothing.
This oh, no?
Is just, I mean, the publisher expends money to put this out, and there's no contract. We don't get anything. My pay for this book is, you know, the number of books that he gave me and also Hélène. So, and that's, I have to say, that's pretty typical for poetry books too, with small presses, that they really are expending, you know, I want to say anywhere between $900 and $1,200 to produce a book, and the poet does not pay for anything. And so it's really an act of faith. And if, you know, the book does well, then, you know, it definitely should go back to the publisher, because they took leap of faith.
Now, at some time, though, do you get the copyright back in the event you want to self-publish it or do something else with it?
Yes. Yes, I believe it does. I think, the copyright stays. Pretty much stays with me. Yeah, translation copyright is on the yes. So absolutely.
Okay. You have also translated a work from the Polish. Please tell us about that.
Oh no, that was not. that was. There is a wonderful translation journal named Circumference.
Right.
It went out of business for a while, but I believe it's back. And they had a contest where they had a Polish phrase, and I think it was called a homophonic contest. Like, in other words, what does this sound like? So poets responded with what it was saying, what they felt it was saying in English. So I know nothing about Polish, but, you know, poets like Bob Holman, myself, we came up with what we thought it might be saying based on the sound of the Polish words. And so it was just an incredibly fun exercise.
Oh, okay. Down to your own poetry. I'm the television show this week, but Vinnie DeQuina, you said something to the effect that poetry may have been your first language. And you've been published in many journals beginning in 1994, but you did not publish your first collection until 13 years later. Why the delay?
I think I had a lousy manuscript, John. I was circulating work, and I think, you know, I took all the work to date and just put it together, and I just don't think it was compelling. And I really wanted to, I realized there was some kind of art to putting a manuscript together, and I worked hard on it, and the title for my first book, Face Painting in the Dark, it came to me in a dream, and I woke up the next day and I knew exactly how to pace and put together my poems to reflect the idea I had. And then that was the book that was, it did take that long. I confess, it's true.
Would you take us through your book publication history? Were they all themed like that? That there was one thing that you wanted?
I mean, the one thing, though, John, the book, Face Painting in the Dark, took a long time, but that was 2014. Before that, in 2007, I had my first chapbook, which is called Sugaring, and that the most part of those poems were based on poems I had written about or in Vermont. So that was extremely encouraging to have that chapbook. And then that was followed by St. Agnes Pink Slipped, which I believe came out, 2011, something like that, or 2012.
2011.
2011. Okay, so again, I was encouraged. It was a little bit longer, a little bit bigger of a chapbook, and you know, both very fine presses that I was very proud of. So the fact that I hadn't had an actual book yet, I was okay with that because I knew I was working towards it.
Okay. As I mentioned, you've been published in many journals and anthologies. One of the most difficult tests for a poet is to determine where to submit poetry. How do you approach the submission process?
Well, I feel anthologies are ideal for poets to send work into because they state a theme. And whereas a journal might be extremely particular about a style of a poem or an aesthetic or craft issues, anthologies are really looking for the heart of the subject. So if I have a poem that really hits that anthology theme, I send it in and, you know, let's say 8 times out of 10, they get accepted because I know it's a really good fit. And then, you know, sometimes they don't. And so I say to myself, you know, the editor had another idea in mind or whatever, didn't care for my poem, and that's fine. But anthologies, I really recommend to people in terms of building their publication credits. And journals, you know, journals, it's a matter of really reading the work that's already there and seeing if it's a fit. I know Linda Simone and I once went to Barnes & Noble on a research mission about, I don't know, this was probably like 20 years ago, to see, look at the journals that we were dying to get into. And when we looked at them, we were horrified by the work, and we said we would never want to be in these journals. You know, this is not our work. This is not the kind of work we do. So it pays to research and know what the content is.
So much of it is also, you mentioned the editor. I had Terry Hummer on, who's the poet who lives in Cold Spring now, but he's previously been the editor of the Kenyon Review, and he's toured all over the country. And he also has been published very often in The New Yorker. And I said, well, that's terrific. And most poets cut off the finger to be published there. So he said, it's funny, there was one editor that liked his stuff and was published there for years. Then they changed editors, and he never got published after that because the next editor didn't. Then a new editor came in, and he's being published there again. Now you wouldn't know that if you didn't read all the time and try to understand what this particular editor liked. That's even harder than trying to figure out perhaps what Curbside Review or one of these others, Okra, would like.
Yeah. No, I remember my mentor, Thomas Lux, you know, bitterly complaining that someone at The New Yorker had queried him for poems, had solicited him for poems. And he was like, well, sure, I'll send some poems. And then the person didn't use any. So, you know, he felt that was like kind of a slap in the face. You know, you ask me for poems, I give you some, and then you don't use them. So, even at that really high level of, you know, Kenyon Review editor, The New Yorker, it's hard to read people.
How would you say that your writing has evolved over the years?
I think I've gone from kind of simple, pastoral, narrative poems that are accessible and remain on a certain level. And now I'm really attempting to dig deeper to more emotional and layered work. And that's involved writing much, much longer poems that reference other people, historical events, Marcel Proust. and it's just more challenging for me. And I'm enjoying that.
Obviously, somewhat experimental, the two parallel trains going during during poetry. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, and it's funny, John, because with Free Fairy, I really got the biggest response to this book from people who don't read poetry. They read it and they loved it, and they read it again and again. And actually, that makes me very happy because, you know, if we as poets can reach new audiences for poetry, then, you know, that's a success story.
Now, you have two active websites, Anagram, which I mentioned earlier, which is also a mailing list, and amtcefola.com. And for your audience, Amtcefola is one word, A-N-N-C-E-F-O-L-A, and that's amtcefola.com. Could you describe these two offerings for us?
Sure. Well, my website basically has my books. I believe my translation's on it. It's just, you know, a good go-to place for my bio. And the Anagram is a blog I've been doing for a long time. And I send it out as an email to more than 300 people around the globe, including Pulitzer Prize winners, editors, musicians, performers. It's really a motley crew of people who read it. And just recently, people have been soliciting me to add their emails to it so they can receive it. People have been sending me news of poetry events so I can post it. So it's become this really lively community. And after I get my stuff out of the way, I really do my best to promote the people I know and maybe the special events that are taking place in the New York area. You know, promotion is really hard for artists, and I recognize that. And if I can help promote the people I know, the artists I know, then I feel like I'm doing some kind of service.
How does one get on the mailing list to Anagram?
People can email me through my website. Go to amtcefola.com and email me and give me your email address, and I'll just add you.
How about that other poem? We've been away from you.
Okay. All right. So, all right. This one is called Missiles. We see them all over. School track the day we honor vets as if a giant dropped toy rockets. On a drive to beach, white tips in a row, also by the dam, Orpheus says, in a silo. My brother names Nike, Ajax, Hercules, Zeus, black numbers, red markings, metal fin. Like television, car, and phone. I don't question. They're part of home.
I like that. That's the kind of ending that Terry always says that I have, to come to an end and stops
do.
And people say, oh.
Yeah, you put, as they say, you put a stinger in the tail.
Yeah. Every year, you and the three friends that you mentioned earlier, Terry Dugan, Ellen Simone, and Sarah Bracy White, who have all been on the show, take a week hiatus from the real world to spend time together in Vermont to work on your writing. Could you describe what exactly happens there?
Yeah, you know, it's like a laboratory. We go up there and we share our latest work, and we get feedback from one another about what we're doing, what works, what doesn't work. And then we really look at promotional activities because, you know, as I said, promotion is hard for writers and poets. And, you know, we know people, we share names, we have suggestions, we're very creative. And it's really a coming together in its purest sense of three artists and just a place to really relax and really kick back and assess where we are, where we'd like to go, and how to do it.
Now, some of the styles are extremely different. Terry's tends to be based in politically from the hard left. Yours is a very different style in the translations. Do you feed off each other and incorporate anything, do you think, from the other person into your work, or do they from you?
I think it's just really, you know, like we're like good writing instructors. Like we understand what the sweet spot is for each person. So, and we can tell them when they're off base because we know the work for so long. So it's just really, I don't think it's like you're suggesting, like an interpollination. It's more really knowing someone's work and what they're capable of, and suggesting that they go either deeper into it or further, or just stay right where it is because they're just doing it perfectly.
I would have thought that, yes. You mentioned that you all met through the Writers Union. I'm a member, but I've never been really active there. Please tell us something about your experience there, if you would.
Well, the National Writers Union had a Westchester Fairfield chapter in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was just fabulous. It had, you know, it was a full-blown organization with, you know, a member phone book, with a yearly conference, with writing groups, one that still goes to this day that Sarah participates in. And unfortunately, I'm sorry to report that politics came into being, and it kind of blew up and disappeared. We were thriving and we were doing so well. I don't know what happened, but the New York office of the Writers Union tried to micromanage us, and basically everyone walked away. So I don't think there's a chapter in Westchester Fairfield anymore, but we were, you know, we had to walk away because we had such a great organization going, and, you know, we couldn't let someone come in and micromanage what we were doing. So that was really
okay.
The end of it. But that was the birth of this wonderful friendship with Linda and Sarah and Terry. In essence, we formed our own union.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, what's next for you?
I think I have another. I have Hélène Sanguinetti's latest book that I look forward to translating, and then I have I have two manuscripts I've been playing around in my head about. I have a certain amount of poems for each one, and you know, I'm doubting myself. I don't know if they're really books or not. So I just have to, as Terry says, make the path by walking. I just have to do it, John, and see what happens when I come out the other side.
That's a good line too.
It's a great line.
We've covered a good deal of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Ansafala?
I think for the past 2 years, I've been really intrigued with writers from the last turn of the century. I especially taken with Marcel Proust, Virginia Woolf, John Dos Passos, and I think what's blowing my mind in reading their work is the nature of the world at the last turn of the century, so much like what's going on today and what we see today, you know, the heated politics, the unnecessary wars, the corruption, the incredible technological advances. I mean, you can read Proust and they're mind blown by looking up in the sky and seeing an airplane, or talking on someone with the, over the phone is an out-of-body experience. And, you know, for me, using the internet and being able to press a button to send a submission into a journal, you know, it's just that easy. You know, there's a part of me that I'm pretty mind blown by what we have at our fingertips at our turn of the century, in the 21st century. So I just feel a kinship with those people who were, those writers who were negotiating this, this great change, you know, this entering modernism. And I feel, I don't know, I feel nourished by them, and I feel understood by them, and I really relate to them.
It's interesting how some of them changed, too. Gus Passos, who I read all his stuff, and his work in the teens, it was really from the left. A mid-century, was conservative, and he became the founder or contributor, anyhow, in the early days, to National Review. So he made almost 180 degree turn.
Yes, but his life was really fascinating. Did you read about that?
Yes.
I think his mother took him all over Europe, and he was educated by just visiting places and having a tutor. So by the time he was a young adult, he was a pretty worldly person. So a friend of mine just recommended a book called When the World Broke in Two, and it's all about Wolf and Eliot and, you know, Proust, and I'm really looking forward to reading it.
That sounds very interesting. When you're mentioning Gus Passos' mother, I just saw something last week that I wasn't aware of. When Franklin Roosevelt went to Harvard, his mother took an apartment in Cambridge.
Hmm.
She was a very domineering woman who Eleanor had some difficulty with.
Hmm.
When Miss MacArthur went to West Point, his mother moved into quarters at West Point. So they
That's
were there
crazy.
To look over their children.
That's really crazy. That's really something. Well, they must have done something right, right?
Well, MacArthur's mother had the right to do that because her husband was a general.
Oh. Interesting.
No, I don't know, and I guess that Sarah Roosevelt just had the money, so she
right.
moved into Cambridge.
Right.
So how about taking us off with another poem?
Okay, let's see. Let me just find one here. Well, here. Okay. Saffron. I stand on the edge of the canal, blue clouded moon above. The swan with spiked gray feathers like oars, while the other birds arc like white pompadours, glides over to say, "And you?" Equally disheveled and splintered. Although an Indian woman at the late summer party told me, "You've got your holy colors on, citrine shirt, orange shawl, like tiny red threads cooked, bleed, amber, and gold." The swan's obsidian eye swallows the black bead of my heart. "And me," I whisper in my vibrant shawl, on the canal edge, the moon bursting forth.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I haven't seen a swan for a long time. I remember the neighbor that I grew up in at the top of Manhattan Island had an inlet, and I remember a swan being there and just getting out as it froze. I don't know where the swan went, but it was almost stuck in the ice there.
Thank you, Anne.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, John. I always love talking to you.
Send any comments or questions to me. about the show at johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week at the same time for my conversation with the poet and author, Jen Karotnik. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, for URLs of previous shows. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, Mr. Sandy O'Neill would see ya. And we'll go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
With you in the desert tonight,
with the billion stars all around, 'cause I got a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm
Thank you again, Ann, and good night, everybody.